Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria, and I'm really excited about this week's episode. We're going to be talking all about global health, but before we do, I want to let you know that today's episode is sponsored by GeekWrapped.com. It's the world's largest collection of unique and badass science gifts. I want you to listen later on in the show for a chance to win one of those cool science products by visiting geekwrapped.com/talknerdy. I also want to thank a handful of people who made this week's episode possible through the PayPal portal, which you can access by visiting carasantamaria.com, where you can make one-time or monthly contributions to the show. I want to thank Nick Ward for his contribution this week, his very large contribution this week. Thank you so much, Nick, all the way from across the pond in the UK. I also want to thank you for the wonderful email you wrote me, and I promise you I am writing you back. I have been crazy this past week, from Austin to New York to Puerto Rico and back again. Haven't had a moment to breathe. I'm actually recording right now at 1 a.m. after I just landed from my flight. So sorry if this intro is a little bit loopy, but I will be sending you an email soon, Nick. Thank you so much for your support over there on the Patreon portal, which you can access by going to www.patreon.com/talknerdy. I want to thank all of you. I mean, there's too many to list. It's like, I don't even know how many there are. I guess it actually says if you go there. Let me see. Let me click on a different page here. Patreon says that right now I have 78 patrons. Holy crap, you guys. Thank you all so much. That is absolutely huge. And for those who are really supporting in a major way, I want to thank Timothy Glover, Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and of course, Chuck Pell. Thank you guys so much. All right. Without further ado, I am pleased to welcome to the show this week, Dr. Jessica Taff. She is a global health scientist, and we talk a lot about infectious disease and especially HIV, something that is both devastating and fascinating. And I hope that you like the talk just as much as I did. Here she is, Dr. Jessica Taff. Jessica, I am so excited to finally be recording with you. I know we've had some technical difficulties in the past. We've been passing also like ships in the night.
Totally.
I was literally just in New York yesterday.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you said you're on the East Coast. That's right.
I know. I'm so frustrated because I wish that I had time to sit down and do this live in person. You were actually here in town when I recorded with Marga, but now we're finally doing it, even though we're doing it from across the continental U.S.
Well, I mean, you know, look, this is like, as we'll talk about later, I work in global health, so interacting with people across time zones, across continents is pretty normal for me.
Is it? So do you tend to have to wake up sometimes in the middle of the night or take really odd hours in order to do all the meetings that you need to do?
Thankfully, no. But I do have a colleague that's on the West Coast, and she's had to do that where she's like getting up at 5 a.m. just to be on normal hours, like with the East Coast, but also in Europe or even if you go like to Asia and stuff. So I thankfully have not yet, but I do get random emails from my boss, and I don't know, or at least one of my bosses. And I have no idea where in the world he is, but it'll come at like 2 a.m. And I'm thinking, like, I know that I'm up at this time, but I kind of want to feel like it's unacceptable for him. But then again, I have no idea where he is.
That's true. He could be someplace and it's like 2 p.m.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm really bad about doing all of my email in the middle of the night, like, because I'm usually either on location recording or I am, I don't know, like just catching up on life stuff when I'm actually have downtime. And it's just, it's quiet. I can focus. So it's usually after midnight when I sit down to answer all my emails for the day. So I'm sure people think I'm insane.
Yeah. Well, for me, it's like I work until late. Like I just, I'm a night owl. I don't know. And I just work a lot. So I tend to just keep going and going. And so sometimes, like, you know, when I'm finally finished something and I'm ready to kind of discuss something, it happens to be sometimes at 1 a.m. Mm-hmm. So I wish that was my excuse, because actually I tend to do the emails in the morning. That's like how I kind of catch up and start my day.
That's smart, actually. You're probably doing it the right way.
I mean, it is. But then, I mean, do you ever wonder how much time it takes to do these things?
I know. Oh, my God. Like, it's such a time suck. But then again, it's also pretty important, I guess,
it,
for work.
It is, right?
It's how we communicate. Can you imagine if we still lived in an era? I mean, we can imagine this because we're not, like, that young. We remember pre-email. And but we weren't working then. We were in school. But imagine if we were, you know, doing, trying to do the same kinds of jobs that we do. And you and I have very different jobs.
Yeah.
And having to, you know, do all of our business over the phone.
Oh, my God.
I know. Doesn't it sound horrible?
I can't even imagine. Well, you know, the funny thing about that is we've gotten so used to, at least I know I have gotten so used to just using email and like text messaging or whatever just to get in touch with people. And sometimes you can't reach people.
Mm-hmm.
And I get frustrated about this. And I, you know, have complained to people about this. They're like, oh, my gosh, I've been held up. I've been trying to get this in touch with this person for so long. And my brother just said to me one day, he's like, Jess, have you ever thought you could just call them? And I'm like, what a concept. Because I've just gotten I almost feel like it's too aggressive, too intrusive.
I feel the same way. Like when people call me, my first thought is how rude. Like, why would they call me without emailing first?
Exactly.
Like, it's so strange.
Don't they know that I could be doing something really important now?
I love this. This is like such a not quite, but a little bit vapid conversation. Right? Especially because, I mean, before our time, obviously, and before probably the time of anybody listening to this episode, you couldn't even call. You had to like write a letter to somebody,
yeah,
send it in the mail, wait to receive their response. I mean, science was slow back in the day.
Yeah, totally.
Very, very slow. And now we're very lucky that we have, we can get instant results with a lot of different kinds of technology that we use. And we can also upload those results instantly. We can publish close to instantly. And we can communicate and collaborate so quickly.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about the way that you do this, the way that you collaborate with people, and really what it means to be a global health scientist, because mm-hmm. I know that's a pretty broad term. Mm-hmm. And what you do or what you have done historically is in certain respects a little bit more specific than that, right?
What do you mean by specific?
You know, like you have a history from what I was reading of epidemiology. Mm-hmm. I guess it's that when you're in this world, right, global health, what does that really mean and what kind of training was required for it? And also, I'm asking you every question at once. I'm just going to wind you up so you can go. And also, you know, what are all the different parameters of this? Because it sounds like it's a community of scientists from like so many different walks of life, so many different backgrounds that come together to really try. And I'm assuming that the common goal is to improve health outcomes across the world.
Absolutely. So, yeah, you're hitting it right on the nail. Like, global health is incredibly multidisciplinary. And I'm coming to it from a scientific perspective, which actually isn't particularly traditional. There's a lot of people that have got masters in public health or people that are involved in international development. There's also economists in the area. But yeah, the general goal is to improve health outcomes. Now, I've always been interested in this for a long time. I think I tell this people, and it's so cliche, but I was the... There are two movies that inspired me to get into this. It's Outbreak and Medicine Man. And essentially, I wanted to put them together. I was like, oh my God, viruses are so freaking cool. You know, it's funny because now I look at that movie and I'm thinking, well, you know, that's interesting. Doesn't quite work out like that. But hey, it's what got me really excited about it and maybe want to approach it from the scientific side, not necessarily from the clinical side.
And so it was really viruses that drew you in at the beginning?
Yeah, like totally.
Okay. So before we complete this journey, I had a recent guest on the podcast. I'm trying to remember, maybe it was Mike Lee when I had him on talking about astrobiology. I think it was Mike. I'm so sorry if it was a different guest, but we took a little detour and we're talking about viruses for a while. And it's pretty funny because it's such a nerd argument to have. like for people who have spent a lot of time in the biological sciences to talk about the true nature of a virus and how viruses are like black magic to a lot of people because they're both sort of alive and sort of not alive.
Yeah.
So I want to get your take on that. Are viruses alive?
I mean, not in the typical sense that they're not an organism, right? I mean, but that to me, that's what is fascinating about them is that they're just these strings of DNA or RNA and proteins. And yet they can hijack a cellular machinery and then replicate and have their own lifestyles there. So I don't consider them alive, even though we do talk about dead viruses, but not in the sense of this is, you know, it's not an organism.
Sure. And so what is the, I know that this is such a weird question to ask because it's not even a very scientific way to approach it, but what is the intrinsic motivation of a virus?
Just to replicate and keep going. Really, it's like almost the same thing that organisms want to do, right? They just want to keep replicating and continue having their DNA passed on.
So it's almost like there's something that's so, I guess, deep and so evolutionarily kind of primordial in the DNA itself or the RNA.
Yeah.
That says, like, I must make more of myself. Even though viruses don't have a brain, they don't have anything close to a brain, they don't even have, you know, organs, they don't have organelles. It's like you said, like, tell people who are listening, if they've never really studied a virus, exactly, you know, what the makeup of a virus is.
I mean, it just depends on your, it could be an RNA virus or it can be a DNA virus. So essentially that is in the center of it, right? That's genetic basis. And then it's encapsulated by the proteins around it. And they have got receptors that help it get into cells or attach, to where it needs to attach in the body. I mean, it's literally just proteins and genetic information.
So it just kind of enters into wherever it would go, whether it's inside the cell, inside the nucleus of the cell or whatever, and it like injects its genetic material.
Sometimes. I mean, sometimes, like, you'll have that for things like retroviruses, like HIV, and it will inject its genetic information into the cellular, the cell itself. And then the cell can, like, it's literally going into the cellular genetics. And
it kind of takes it in its genetics actually change.
Yeah. Now, some other viruses don't do that. They just kind of, like, influenza will go into a cell and then it has has machinery, or it'll use the cellular machinery to replicate. And it's not necessarily inserting its own genetic information into the cell itself. Like, it's coming in as like a particle.
Gotcha. And so the reason that we get so sick when those kinds of viruses enter us is just because our immune system is working on overdrive to clear them out.
I mean, that's definitely true for viruses that kind of like have a strong immune activation that go along with it. I mean, that's something, that's why people get AIDS essentially, is that there's such an immune response, and it's chronic that you just tire out your system. And this can, you know, the natural history of infections, like 8 to 10 years, right? Now, if this is just the virus is continually replicating, you just tire out your immune system. And then those important cells like T cells, you don't have as many of them anymore. You used to have a really good stock of them and then they just get tired out. And then all of a sudden you're left with a really low capacity to fight other diseases because you've just exhausted your system.
And that's usually when people do die of AIDS. It's not the AIDS. I mean, the AIDS is what, you know, makes them more susceptible to generally dying of something like pneumonia or some other infection. But what about flu? You know, you said that flu, for example, doesn't enter into our DNA. Flu just replicates in our cells. So why do we feel so horrible when we have the flu?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's just an immune response that happens there. Now, some viruses, not necessarily, I mean, well, flu has got virulence factors. But this is not just like viruses. This is also bacteria. This is parasites. I mean, one of the characteristics of malaria, another disease that I've worked on, is, you know, you have this cyclical fevers. Well, essentially what that is that that's your body responding to the replication and growth patterns of the parasite, like whenever it bursts and it goes into the bloodstream and then you just have all these fevers. That's your body's way of fighting off disease is through this immune response. Now, yeah, you could feel like crap because no, it's not cool to like raise your body temperature and, you know, send all these like chemokines out and everything that goes on in a typical acute immune response. So that's why you feel bad.
But within, I guess, reasonable parameters, a fever is a good thing. A fever shows that your body's doing what it's supposed to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we've been talking about viruses only because I made you, because I think they're really interesting. But you are not a virologist specifically, per se. You actually are trained as, what, an epidemiologist?
No. And it's funny. Yeah, like you're having me talk about viruses. And I love them. I really do. But I almost kind of tend to them like, oh, God, am I saying the right things? But it's been a long time since I've you know, taken a class on this. My PhD... I tell people like it's in microbiology. That's basically what it was. It was microbiology, virology, and parasitology.
Oh, okay. So it's kind of all of the gross things that can get inside a body and make you sick.
Yeah. So that was the academic program. But my thesis was on HIV immunopathogenesis. So I'm a person that I would say, like, I know a good amount of immunology. I know a good amount of information about viruses and HIV. And I know some information about pathology. So it's really across the board. I wouldn't say I'm an expert in any of them. But I know enough about all of them, especially as it relates to HIV and malaria, because that's essentially how I've applied that training.
Gotcha. So you were looking at, when you were back in school, you were looking at how does an infectious agent enter into the body and make somebody sick? And then beyond that, I guess within the global health community, that information is taken on by a lot of other types of experts who look at patterns of disease throughout the world and how can we work on sort of minimizing the spread of these diseases.
Pretty much. I mean, that is, you know, from the biomedical side and my, like, you know, bench science perspective, that is how the body responds to a pathogen has always been really interesting to me. Now, there's two ways that you can kind of think about disease and pathogenicity. Is that there's something that the pathogen does directly to the body. It has a virulence factor, or it causes some sort of response that's just not good. But then there's just like we were talking about, that the body itself just overreacts. And it's the immune response that makes you sick or causes disease. So those things are interesting to me.
And this is kind of like, I don't want to say a new perspective, but it's a perspective that has been gaining more, I guess, public understanding and acceptance lately. I definitely have been reading more and more papers now than I did when I was younger about, you know, inflammatory factor, like different factors involved in disease process, and how controlling those things can potentially have better outcomes than just worrying about the pathogen.
We've had such a pathogen-centric way of dealing with, let's say, in terms of treatments and vaccines, but that's not necessarily, I don't want to say it's not the right way, but it's
maybe not the only way.
Yeah, that's a good thing. I think it's not the only way. For instance, if you look at HIV, we're attacking the virus itself. But the reason why people end up getting really sick from it and dying is really the immune response, a chronic immune response. But there aren't any treatments out there or that are on the market or approved that to treat the immune response to it.
Oh, interesting.
So, I mean, like I said, all the HIV drugs are against the virus itself. And it works because, look, you've got part of the reason is the virus keeps replicating. So your body keeps responding to it. So if you attack the virus and keep it from replicating, okay, you know, you're doing something about it, but it's kind of an indirect way, I think.
Yeah, because then you're basically nipping it in the bud. But that really only works for people who are diagnosed HIV but haven't progressed yet to AIDS, or for people who catch it at a certain stage of the disease. I definitely, back when I was working for a neuropsychologist, I remember seeing patients who, you know, we were doing like neuropsych assessment, so different tests to see their brain functioning. And, you know, we saw some patients that were late stage AIDS, and late stage AIDS patients do often suffer from dementia. It's like one of the things that happens. And I remember taking histories on some of these patients and talking to them. And there was more than one person that I met who, when they were first diagnosed, they were already at the AIDS stage.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And at that point, do we really have a lot that we can do?
There's really not much you can do besides try to keep them healthy as much as you can, and keep them
comfortable
and away from infections that that could kill them.
Sure. And this is obviously also an issue that we see in the way that we treat infections now. How do I put this? So I had MRSA once.
Oh, my goodness.
It was awful. Yeah. And I was lucky enough that it was a soft tissue. You know, it's only in my skin. Mm-hmm. I caught it. I didn't catch it as early as I should have because it was in my underarm. And so I thought it was like an ingrown hair, which I think is really common. Or people might have it on their, you know, inner thigh or something. And they just think it's like a spider bite. So you end up going a little longer than you should without treating it. And so it was pretty gross. I went into the dermatologist. I was like, I think something is legit wrong. It's getting worse and it really hurts. And they had to do the standard. They lanced it open. They took a sample. Yeah, it sucked. You know, they went ahead and started treating me and at the same time put it in the Petri dish, put the different antibiotics on it, figured out which ones worked, had to stop the antibiotic they put me on because it was resistant to that. And I went through a course of like 3 antibiotics, 2 months of treatment. It was horrible. But my situation was not as bad as some people's. Now, the reason I'm saying all of this is I had community acquired MRSA. Mm. I think at the time I was living in New York, my roommate worked at a gym. I'm pretty sure he brought it home. You know, the rest is history. But a lot of people, as we know, have hospital acquired. They get hospital acquired superbugs. So and we're finding that actually the same place where you treat these infections are the places where a lot of people are getting sicker.
Oh, that's a real problem.
Right? It's like such a bummer because you're in the hospital already. Mm-hmm. You have an IV in your arm, so you have an open wound. Maybe you, whatever disease you're dealing with also has like, you know, lacerations or different skin breaches. And then you can actually catch more infection because hospitals are they're as clean as they try to be. These antibiotic resistant bugs are like they're fastidious.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, like, yeah, nosocomial infections is a risk with antibiotic resistant pathogens. But not just that, like one of the things that I was thinking about just today in some of the work that I was doing was MERS. And, mm-hmm. you know, that was another nosocomial transmission that happened in South Korea.
And was MERS a respiratory infection?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Okay, it was like the new SARS.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's how the public took it, you know, because I know nothing about infectious disease. So in my mind, I was like, MERS, new SARS.
Yeah.
Is that a dumb way to put it? No.
Okay. No, no, no. I mean, it's another coronavirus. Gotcha. And it's also, transmitted potentially from, I don't know if that confirmed or not.
But from a farm animal or something like that.
Camels.
Oof.
Camels. Yikes. Or at least it's a there's enough evidence to suggest that it's coming from camels, but but I think the evidence is limited in terms of whether they can show the causality, if that makes sense.
Like there's so it's like Ebola. Like I think that most epidemiologists think at this point that it's from bats, but you can't actually fully prove it yet, right? Like they've not actually found the bats.
Yeah. I don't know what the data is with Ebola, but yeah, definitely from bats. Yeah. And then, I mean, for sure in the bushmeat, like that would be the
exactly
the intermediate host that we're getting it from.
But that reservoir, mm-hmm. I guess then the camel's probably the intermediate host with MERS, huh? But the reservoir animal, the one that never loses it, the one that's always kind of hiding and always infected, and that's the reason these things will always keep popping back up.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to figure out who that is.
It is, unless you're doing the work, unless, you know, that you've got to have people out in the field, which, that's something I'm really passionate about is the emerging infectious diseases and zoonotic diseases and understanding health in context with the natural environment and the animal environment.
Fascinating. Yeah. And we don't, I think in the general public, we don't think about it much. We think about, okay, people get sick from disease.
Oh, yeah.
We don't think about all these disease reservoirs that are existing out there. We don't think about how the next thing that is going to happen kind of fast, where we're not going to have a vaccine developed before a lot of people get very sick, will probably be a spillover.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing that I'm really passionate about is that we don't focus enough on prevention and surveillance. Look, to be fair, I understand that sometimes there's just too many fires going on that we need to take care of to really focus as much on prevention as we need to. But I don't like the attitude of, okay, if it happens, then we'll deal with it then. No, I think if you nip it in the bud, and there's a lot of ways you can nip a potential outbreak in the bud, you know, even if it's just through surveillance and keeping up with animal populations, or even just making sure that you have health systems in place that can deal with whatever infection or health emergency comes up.
Yeah, I mean, some people would argue that that's exactly what happened, that this exact same concern can be applied to the Ebola mm-hmm. outbreak, that like scientists said, this will come back. Mm-hmm. This is existing in a reservoir in nature. We can't control when the next spillover event occurs. We should be working on it while nobody is sick so that when people get yeah. sick next, we can do something about it. And we just didn't allocate the resources to that.
No. But here's the thing is, and it was just a year ago, right? Yeah, it was just a year ago. I remember, yeah, because it's just like, what, last August, end of August. I remember all of the media buzz about this. And I remember mm-hmm. hearing what the public was saying. And there was just this, why don't we have a vaccine? Why don't we have this? And these are yeah. excellent questions. And the issue became very politicized. And that bothered me. Because one, yes, I'm coming from the science side of it, but I also want to talk about and understand like the larger, broader health aspects of it, in that mm-hmm. it's great to be putting out vaccines for, you know, specific diseases. But like you said, we cannot predict what the next disease is going to be. You know, MERS came up, you know, we're having
emerging. Yeah, that was not even, it was like just new.
Yeah.
It was one of those things yeah. where scientists were like, I have never seen this before.
Exactly. So we can't predict one, what's going to come out of animals. We can't predict what's going to go into humans. So I think when they do come up, yeah, awesome. All right. So MERS is here. Let's work on a vaccine. But we also need to be doing the things to ensure that we can handle whatever comes up. And I mean, because you can't make this total, you know, a vaccine that tackles every emerging virus, right? Or, you mm-hmm. know, so I think there's other things that we need to be doing, not just from the, you know, biomedical side of things.
So like, what are some examples of the things that maybe if we were more, you know, on point about it could help us in the future?
Definitely with Ebola, right? I mean, girl, mm-hmm. okay, so we did know about that one, but
we hadn't had a real big outbreak since, what, the 70s? Or maybe the 90s, I guess, was
this was
one. But the
largest outbreak that we've ever yeah. had. I mean, they've never been this large in scope. And
no. And that's because back when it did, back when we had those isolated outbreaks, like in the Congo, the Congo wasn't globalized the way it is now. Even
exactly.
when we think of remote areas in Africa, people can still travel now. People are on cell phones. And it's going to spread.
Well, I mean, these are some of the things that we need to be doing. You know, like, there's the science, the biomedical research, there's the technology you apply, but there's also just, you know, old-fashioned public health measures and some maybe newer public health measures that are aided by new technology or that are more appropriate for where we are in, you know, in terms of the day and age. But, you know, mm-hmm. like things like border control. I don't want to say that carefully. I'm not advocating that we should, you know, do border control all the time. But if they're, like, I was just at the airport coming back from Mexico, was it last week, I think? And, mm-hmm. you know, and I took a picture out on Twitter because I was kind of excited. And, I mean, there were just some signs, really colorful ones about, like, have you traveled to so-and-so? Because, like, do you feel this way? Because this is endemic in these regions, or that he's, like, a travel health advisory. Like,
yeah, that's really great. I just saw that at JFK yesterday.
Yeah.
There was two of them. There was an Ebola one that kind of described, if you're going to these
yeah.
different regions, be careful, and this is what you should do if you feel this way. And then there was one for like dengue and chikungunya, mm-hmm. like for people who are going south.
Yep.
Which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, because I mean, like, that's public health measures like that, community awareness, not just like among the public, but also healthcare professionals. I mean, that's another thing, right?
Like, oh yeah, like not misdiagnosing, uh-huh. like actually keeping in mind, okay,
yeah.
let's get a real history on this person to see if they went somewhere where they would have gotten malaria before we send them home and tell them they had the flu.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, like with stuff with like, it could be malaria, but a lot of these diseases present in the same way with fevers mm-hmm. and chills and, you know, it could be a number of things. So if a doctor sees that, they need to think, oh, it could be this, but where did they go? Because maybe it's looking like malaria, but maybe it's dengue or maybe it's chikungunya.
Mm-hmm. And let's think about the difference. Like if I accidentally misdiagnose Ebola as malaria, there could be like catastrophic outcomes if I send this person home.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And also it seems like with things, I keep going back to Ebola because it's fascinating to me and because it's like fresh in my mind. And because, as everybody knows, I'm constantly hawking David Quammen's book Spillover. It's so good.
You know,
and
I think I heard you talk about one of your other podcasts and I was thinking, I need to read that.
It's so good. And you'll be like, I already know all this stuff. But it's endlessly readable, I think, for people who don't have the same backgrounds that you have, which is important because it's complicated. This stuff is so complicated. But I think we all have the same reaction to Outbreak. And then later, what was the
Medicine
the
Man.
More recent one?
Oh, Contagion. Yeah, Medicine
Contagion. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. And so, and it's funny because all of a sudden we're experts, right? We're watching and we're like, oh, patient zero. I know all about that. I know all about the R naught. And like, you know, we just like think we know everything after we see that. But this book is just very informative and it talks about where AIDS potentially started and like, I didn't realize it was so much like we think about AIDS starting in the 70s, but this guy's talking, but Quammen's writing about how they were finding samples from like the 40s and 50s. It's just it hadn't been able to spread because it was in these very isolated areas.
Well, you know that HIV, the precursor to it, was a non-human primate virus, right?
Yeah, it was in chimps, right?
Well, yes, before that, but even before. So that's actually the subject of my PhD thesis was, like... Okay, I feel like I'm going to have to take a moment because I'm like, I'm going to geek out, but...
No, I want you to geek out. But you know what? I just realized we are already halfway through the podcast and I need to give a quick shout out. So what I want you to do is take your moment. I'm going to tell everybody that we will be right back. I'm actually doing that in real time. Everybody will be right back and we're going to talk a little bit more with Jessica Taff and we're going to be talking about HIV because it's fascinating. Okay. All right, guys, I want to thank GeekWrap.com for supporting today's episode of Talk Nerdy. At GeekWrap.com, you will find an incredible selection of fun science-themed gifts. Their goal is to popularize science through products that stimulate the imagination. And even better, they help to advance science by donating 50% of all of their earnings to national charities. And just for you guys, the Talk Nerdy listeners, I've partnered this week with GeekWrap to give away 3 really cool science gifts, including a 3D printed T-Rex shower head. Rawr. I don't think that's what T-Rex actually sounded like. A laboratory party shot glass set. These really cute little shot glasses that are shaped like beakers and Erlenmeyer flasks. And lastly, a crazy shower gel that looks like an IV bag that's full of blood. It's amazing. All right, guys, you can enter to win one of these 3 great gifts for you or for someone you love by visiting geekwrapped.com/talknerdy. What are you waiting for? Visit geekwrapped.com/talknerdy. Good luck. All right, we are back with Dr. Jessica Taff, and we were just about to get into some of the research that she did for her PhD. I am really fascinated by HIV and AIDS and how it came to be because it's one of these diseases that I think is so culturally relevant. It's such a huge part of our existence, both in the States and across the world, because it hasn't gone away. We don't know if we're going to be able to eradicate this disease. And it had all these weird political, you know what I mean? It was such a heavy thing. It still is. And so many people still suffer from it. And I think both from a cultural perspective and a medical scientific perspective, it's just something that I'm really interested in.
I love talking about HIV for all those reasons. I mean, it's funny because when I started grad school, I had no intention of ending up working on HIV. I had none, none whatsoever. And then I ended up rotating in like 3 HIV labs. And then I left grad school, went to malaria, and now I'm back working on HIV again, now from a completely different perspective. But I'm like more working from a programmatic side.
And what does that mean?
I'm not working on it from the bench side and thinking about the medical science. I think about it in terms of where are we putting our HIV resources. So I work for the World Bank, the global HIV AIDS team. And so a lot of it is in terms of the HIV response on a global level, but not just on the global level. Like, how are we helping countries? Where are they putting their resources for HIV in terms of treatment, care, and prevention?
Gotcha.
So, and there's actually a lot of science, not biomedical science, but like there's a lot of evidence base there. But I definitely more involved in it from the side of like having to understand what are the cultural implications? What are the structural factors that are driving transmission? It's not just the fact that like, you know, in terms of the virus going into cells, you have to think about people. And so anyway.
Yeah. And about how like, you know, how religion plays into it. How does public, I don't know, like trust in the government or the military, all of those things really play into
poverty.
Poverty, exactly.
Inequality, gender inequality. Like, I mean, this is like I was just saying, I can geek out over this both from like the biomedical side, but also from the more social side of it. Like HIV is such a good example.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also very sad. You know what I mean? It's something that it's fascinating, but when you take a step back and you kind of get out of the weeds of it, you realize like this is a real massive health crisis.
Yeah.
And it hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
It's gotten way better. And especially in the West, it's gotten way better. And I think that we shouldn't forget that. And we shouldn't say, this is amazing how far we've come. But there are parts of the world where it's almost as bad as it ever was.
There are pockets in the United States where the numbers are just, in terms of percentages, are just as bad as they are in sub-Saharan Africa.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Where I think I remember
in like
reading
Baltimore,
that.
I think I've seen
Baltimore,
that, yeah.
And maybe I think in D.C. also in certain.
Yeah, regions. I've heard that as well. So, yeah. But like, so, I mean, going back to the biomedical side of it. Okay, so I'll start geeking out on the one aspect I like to geek out about.
Yes, please.
So HIV comes from SIV, which is simian immunodeficiency virus. And this is a virus, like, you know, you were talking about reservoirs and like natural hosts. Well, this is the natural reservoir are monkeys. And the subject of my thesis and topic was definitely understanding why when people are infected with these type of viruses, they do or do not get sick, or they don't have an immune response. Because in the monkeys, it's actually not really pathogenic.
Oh, I see. And also, there are people who can be exposed to HIV and they don't get sick.
This is true.
Which
you have like long-term non-progressors, so that was another aspect that I worked on as well. But yeah, so SIV was in the monkeys, and then when it went into the ape host into chimps, then it does cause disease, and then from apes it jumped into humans. But yeah, this
is
you know, it's been a long jump. So you've got the zoonotic aspects of it, you've got the immunology and all that sort of stuff, and you know, what is, like, you're talking about how this came about and spread, and you're talking about they were able to find samples from the 40s. Yeah, well, because it's not okay, the thing about HIV, it actually doesn't spread really, like, it's not easy to get HIV.
Yeah, I think that that's kind of a misnomer. Like, that's something that misnomer is not the right word, but it's a myth, you know. We think that it's like, so I guess, is virulent the right word? What does that word actually mean, virulent?
Virulent is in terms of like how pathogenic, like in terms of the severity of disease or
gotcha. So if you get it, how sick do you become?
More or less, yeah,
bad
exactly.
Do you feel? Okay, so it's more, it's not as communicable, I guess would be the right word, as we think of it as being.
Yeah.
It's, you can't get it from, you know, spit. You can't get it from breathing the same air. And even some people who have sex
exactly
with somebody else won't get it.
It like, you're not going to get it. I mean, you could. It's statistical, right? So you have, I want to say it's like 1 in 100. Maybe that's an acute infection.
Gotcha. That,
I don't know if those numbers have been updated, but yeah, that's it's not that easy. Not that I'm advocating to go and, you know, put yourself in risky positions.
No, because you still can get it.
Yeah.
It's still easier than we would like, but it's
exactly.
But yeah, I do think that because of the scare of how quickly it spread in the United States in the 70s and 80s, and that wasn't because it's so spreadable. It's because we didn't even know what it was.
Exactly. Well, and that's, a lot of people were having unprotected sex. There's also, if you're having men having sex with men, they're having anal sex. And there's a biomedical reason that it actually, in that context, it is more transmissible because that type of sex tends to be rougher on mucous membranes. Therefore,
you have more blood.
You have more micro tears. So it's, you know, it's easier to spread that way. But there's also like the other factors that are going along in terms of having multiple networks of mm-hmm. sexual networks. So it's not just monogamous relationships back and forth.
And also when you're living, when you have a lifestyle that has so far presented, you know, very minimal risk, when, you know, yes, STDs always existed. And I think historically people who were living the kind of lifestyle where they had multiple partners would be aware of that. You'd go to your doctor, you would get tested. You might take an antibiotic when you needed to take an antibiotic, but HIV wasn't on the map.
No, not at all. Like I love talking about this because there's just so many ways to think about HIV, and it's just been such a story, mm-hmm. you know, an infectious disease story of this past century, you know, the past, you know, 30, 40 years. And I recently saw The Normal Heart, and God, that broke my heart.
Oh, I know. Yeah, that was that HBO movie with a bunch of great people in it, right? Mm-hmm. Mark Ruffalo and mm-hmm. also... What's his name from Big Bang Theory? Sheldon.
Oh, like yeah, Sheldon. He was in there. Wasn't he?
He was in it, yeah. Oh, and also
Matt Bomer.
Julia Roberts. Yes, yes. Lots of great people.
Yeah, totally. Lots of great people. It was fantastic. And it just demonstrated the social aspects of infectious disease and epidemics. And when you have neglected populations for whatever reason, I mean, some of these things are still going on in parts of the world.
And how much, like, what's the word I'm looking for? How much stigma comes along? Yeah. You know, that was what happened is when AIDS first started spreading and nobody knew what it was dubbed the gay plague.
Yeah.
That's what people called it. That's what people thought of it. It's not because people who were heterosexual didn't get it, but early on, the numbers were just striking mm-hmm. in that population versus needle users or heterosexual partners, because that was really a nucleated site. Wasn't patient zero in the U.S. a gay flight attendant?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and so it started in that community.
Yeah.
Obviously, we see that it spreads like wildfire through almost any community if it's unchecked, but in this, that's where it started, so that's where it got all of those really bad stigmas attached to it.
Exactly. Well, and then when they went into Africa, they saw that it wasn't just in the gay communities, and it was heterosexual transmission. It was,
yeah, totally.
And
but it just gave another excuse for, I think, a cultural... rejection of a certain part of society that was already there, a very deeply religious kind of gay fear and hatred. It just gave them more ammunition, which was a very sad situation. And also, like you said, they were just neglected. This was a population of society that kind of, they didn't feel like it was worthwhile to investigate this fully because, oh, it's only happening to those guys.
Oh, yeah. Right. I mean, you know, if you want to attach, you know, moral judgments on that, I mean, this is still happening today where you've got like sex workers, you have transgenders, you have people that use drugs. These are other at-risk populations. And then in some epidemics are primarily driving the transmission in those epidemics,
which is so sad, because then you have certain types of politicians who actually want to dry up funding because they, for whatever reason, think that this is like their just desserts. It's disgusting. Like that, oh, well, it's because these people are this way that they're getting these diseases, and not really looking at it like, obviously, all people are created equally, and we need to help people who don't have the means to help themselves even more.
So this is another thing that, like, I mean, I think, because I work for the World Bank, and I've gotten much more of an appreciation for the economics of development and global health and stuff. So I do think that, you know, like you said, everyone deserves to have access to treatment, and, you know, no one should be treated differently. But there are politics involved, and I know, and there's plenty of people that would like to use the moral and social justice argument. And I think that's fine, but I don't think it works with governments. And I think the stronger argument is just to put it, you know, and attach numbers is when
sure.
you say,
is to say, if these people are sick, there's more risk for you.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying, like, it's not because that's my personal like view on it. It's just when you're
it's
going,
more effective.
When you're going in and you go to a country and you say, hey, you've got an AIDS epidemic going on, and we can show you the long-term effects of this is what it's going to be on your economy. You know, yeah, okay, maybe it's happening in a population you don't want to address or you don't respect, but if you don't, it's going to grow, and this is going to be the effect. It's not just going to be the effect. It's not going to like just take out those populations. It's going to trickle over into the general population, and maybe not necessarily the infection, but that's potential. But it's going to affect your it's could destabilize things, or you know, like there's a lot of
and it
otherwise.
Does.
Yeah,
I mean, it is like it's there. It's maybe it is a coincidence. I don't think it's a coincidence, but there are heavy, you know, correlations between areas of the world where there is a little stability in government and like rampant infectious disease.
That has been one of the things that I was worried about with Ebola. Like, what's going to happen in West Africa? You know,
yeah, will it affect, I mean, will it make things worse, not just from this perspective of people getting sick,
yeah,
but in terms of, you know, more distrust for authority, and also, you know, when there's sort of, you know, dictatorships, or you have these areas where the military and the sort of political power are at odds with each other, and then you have this whole other layer that just adds so much, I guess, distrust, that's a word I keep using, and questioning just and fear.
Destabilization. I mean, like, yeah. I laughed in, back there, and I don't want to say because not that I think it's funny. It's more this uncomfort and of out of frustration of, again, I remember last year the people were saying, why don't we have a vaccine? Why don't we have this? And I thought, okay, those are important questions, but we need to be asking, why did this happen? Why were we not able to address it? Why isn't there a health system in place that could have kept it from spreading or could have treated these people? I mean,
exactly. Because even if we get a vaccine, the real question is going to be, can we get it to the people that need it?
Exactly.
Like, the issue is not that the vaccine doesn't exist.
No, exactly. And that's what I was getting upset about, is like, okay, these are important questions, but let me tell you what's in a more important question. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until we started citing global security reasons that I think the world picked up its ears and was like, Oh, yeah, this does threaten global security. So
yeah.
Economics.
And that's so sad. That's so sad, but it's so necessary. Yeah. Like you said, it's more effective. Like, I've always wondered why we don't put, and we do in the U.S., don't get me wrong, we give money and we give aid to a lot of areas in sub-Saharan Africa. But I've always wondered why we don't look at some of the crises that are happening there as national security risks.
When we should, I mean, and some of them are and some of them aren't, but it's that's what I think drives people to do something. It's money and it's security.
Yeah. And I mean, when you look at a map of infectious diseases, you know, you've seen these epidemiological maps where like they highlight different areas, like origin areas and populations where they're not under control yet. It's so sad because there are regions, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, that are just like lit up like a Christmas tree.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And you're like, Jesus, these people are suffering. Mm-hmm. And that's the humanitarian view. Man, these people are suffering. But then again, that cold kind of economic view like you're talking about is like, oh, fuck, if we don't get this area under control, it could spread to all these other areas.
I mean, that's how, in my view, that's how you get people to act on things. Because not everyone's going to agree with you in terms of what is, like, even if they agree with you on the humanitarian reasons, they're going to have different priorities. Like, look, I'm an infectious disease geek, like, completely. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, yes, and health and everything. But even within health, there are people that are saying, hey, you know what? Diabetes is a huge problem in these countries. So you're going to have competing health priorities. Not even that. You've got people that are saying, okay, well, what about education? These people need education. And if you improve education, you know what? People the country will develop more economically. People may have safer health behaviors. Like, there's just so many ways to approach these things, and there's competing priorities. So
and that must be so frustrating, because you stand back and you go, yep. Yeah,
oh,
no, I agree
absolutely.
With that. Absolutely. Oh, yes. Yes. Let's give all the money to all of the things. And then you realize the pie's only so big.
Exactly.
So what do? I mean, how do you, God, now I'm getting frustrated. what do you do about this?
I think you have to take, and here's what I was saying, kind of like I still am involved in science. It's not your typical science, but it's still data and evidence based. I think you have to think about what are the best arguments and how do you back them up with evidence. So we do this a lot for HIV, where we are looking at, there's different ways of divvying up AIDS resources in terms of, and then you have to decide how much is going to go into prevention activities. And even within prevention, are we talking about counseling and condoms, or are we also talking about things that are also important, such as like harm reduction, needle exchange, circumcision.
And these are all things where the evidence supports that they do work.
Exactly. But you have to think about what combination to use them, or and how much we're going to treatment, because treatment as prevention is a big thing that's been shown to reduce transmission in populations. So what we do is we do epidemic modeling, and I'm actually citing a lot of what the World Bank does, but they're not the only ones that do it. Cost effective analysis. So you say, okay, if you put this much money into this, you can avert this many infections, or you can prevent this many deaths. And then you come up with evidence, and then you take that to policymakers and you say, here you go. Or you ask policymakers, what is your main goal? What would you like to do? Do you want to avert the number of deaths? Do you want to decrease, or do you want to make the most out of the money that you have right now? Or let's just say you can improve your budget by 20%. You know, what should you do with that money? And then you come up with strategies for them.
God, that sounds like just so daunting, because it's like you do all of this work to collect all of this data from a massive network of amazing scientists and not just scientists, but people with boots on the ground, you know, like global health experts across many fields. You crunch all those numbers, you start to come up with recommendations, and then you have to go to these areas and speak to these leaders that are often not stable areas where there's a lot of regime change and where the leaders may not have the best interest of the people at heart. Or even if they do, like you said, they have competing priorities.
Exactly.
And somehow convince them of what they should do, or help work with them to figure out the best thing to do. So how frustrating is it when you put all of this time and effort into coming up with a really solid game plan that you think could really affect change, and then you go and you're talking to a wall and they say, no, we're not going to implement any of that.
You know, I haven't been put in that position yet, so I can't comment exactly, but
I'm sure it's not uncommon.
No,
I'm sure the real frustration for a lot of people in this position come from literally watching all of the work that they've done not be implemented, standing on the sidelines and saying, God. And, you know, it's like that thing where you're sitting on your hands and you're like, no, just do this.
Yeah.
If you would just do this, you'd be amazed to see what happens. And then people don't, or they can't.
I think I've experienced it, maybe not quite at that level, but with other things, or I think even in science, you know, like, or like at the bench, you think your research is the coolest, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't understand why anyone else doesn't think it's so cool. Like, why didn't it get into this journal, or why didn't I get this talk, right? I think at some point you have to just kind of take a step back. And I think like there's things that I work on where, I was writing a paper on hepatitis and how actually viral hepatitis is becoming a global health threat, and people need to advocate for that. And I generally believe, you know, this should happen. Will someone do anything about it? I don't know, but I'm writing it and we'll get it out there. And I think there has to be a balance of really being connected to your work, but not, because when you work in this sphere, you have to understand that just because you think this is the way it needs to be doesn't mean that everyone's going to agree with you, and you don't understand everything else that's going on. You don't understand the competing priorities. And I think you have to keep an open mind, and I think you have to talk to these people and you have to level with them. And I think you also have to come at them very carefully, not this, oh, I have all the data, let me show it to you. I mean, it's, you know.
Yeah, I think that history has proven that, like, you know, the Western white powers that be swooping in to what we think of as a developing nation and saying this is what's best for you doesn't always work.
No.
Actually, most often it doesn't work. It's about getting into the mindset of the people and having boots on the ground and really working with their priorities.
And respecting them and understanding that you can learn from them too. I mean, oh my God, like I'm so amazed sometimes when I hear about innovation that's coming out of these countries that you're not expecting it. And when people have less resources, sometimes they innovate so much better. And I mean, like,
oh yeah, and come up with brilliant technologies or programs that, because we don't often think it, you know, I feel like in the West we're not thinking about how to do things inexpensively that have a major impact. We're thinking about profit motives.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's crazy when you see, you know, a malaria test that's just looking at it from a new way, and it costs 10 cents to do this test, and it could save so many lives.
I know. And I think that's something you get from being in those environments. Like you said, being on the ground, living through those things. Like when I see some innovations that come out or cool new tests or approach or strategies, I'm like, where did they come up with the idea? Why didn't I ever think about that? And it's just, if you're not exposed to, or if you don't understand, like if you're not presented with the problem, then why would you ever stop what you're doing, right? You know?
And also, like, how you can only gain so much perspective from reading books,
yeah,
you know, and from watching documentaries, and from like, and you can be the most empathetic person in the world. And I'm not denigrating the amount of like love and passion, mm-hmm, and respect that comes from people who live across the world trying to solve problems in those regions. And I'm not saying they're not empathetic. I'm not, mm-hmm, saying you're not empathetic. I'm not saying I'm not empathetic, but like, you really can't gain full perspective until you are a part of the culture.
Yeah, no, that's until really true.
You know, you're always going to not quite get certain societal norms, certain, you know, things in the language or perspectives. Like, why is it that that's always got a negative connotation? Why is it that this thing always feels a little bit like it's, you know, other than? Because it's so imbued. It's, mm-hmm, so like deep within the culture. And, you know, I have to say, sitting here as kind of like an armchair activist, especially with regards to these issues, how much I respect the people who literally uproot their lives to go and work with populations that, you know, are worlds away.
Mm-hmm.
Like I can sit here and be like, it's gross when Americans don't think outside of their borders and when Americans never travel and when Americans aren't concerned about what's happening. I hated the fact that we didn't give a shit about Ebola,
yeah,
until we got some aid workers come back to,
yeah,
the States.
Exactly.
And then all of a sudden, you know, and then Trump is saying like, send them back, secure. And you're like, Jesus Christ. Like, that's disgusting to me.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the flip side of that is that there are selfless people who leave their homes, they leave their families, and they go live in like literally really fucking difficult places, mm-hmm, where they're risking death and they're risking disease and they're risking harm just to try to help solve a problem that would be very easy for them to just pretend doesn't exist.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, there's definitely those people out there. I mean, and then they're to be respected, you know, and applauded, you know, like some,
yeah,
of those people, like, oh my God. Granted, sometimes I wonder how many of those like emergency health workers are a little bit of, you know, adrenaline junkies.
I'm sure. I mean, there's got to be another motivation because you can only be so pure of heart for so long. But either way, it's still incredible.
Oh,
you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah. No, they did great work for sure.
It's just, yeah, I don't know. I don't think we take the time sometimes to stop and really think about what that must be like, you know, to daydream about why there's no way in hell I would ever do that for a living because I'm too selfish, you know, and to stop and think about the kind of person that would and the kind of person that would be willing to give and really risk their lives to help save other people, you know, people who go out with Doctors Without Borders and you know, with the World Health Organization and with UNICEF and all these different organizations, with the UN.
But, you know, here's another way to look at it, right? You know, because, I mean, I think there's parts of, I've asked myself some of those questions as well. You know, I could be going out and doing field work, or I could move somewhere else. And, you know, and then, like, there was even parts of me when I was deciding whether I wanted to go into science, and, like, get my PhD or be a doctor. Because, like, I'm interested, mm-hmm, in infectious diseases, and you can approach public health from both perspectives. And I had made the decision that, no, Jess, you're good at science, and this is the way that you can help out. And, you know, and so I did. I did my PhD, and I, you know, did my postdoc, and I did all the bench work. And now I'm not doing that as much. But I also, part of the reason I got out of it was just that I knew that I also had other skills. And not only just had the other skills, I wanted to and cared very much about kind of the things that we've been talking about, the things that go much beyond just like the pathogen cellular interactions and what it does to the body. I mean, there's these social, cultural, structural issues that I appreciated and thought were also very important. And I thought it's really important to like combine all of them, understand them. And I think that I, you know, one, I love talking about it. So there's that. And so I know that's, I mean, if talking is a skill, I think I have it.
Yeah, no, and I think that that's an important point to make. Is it's a point I try to make in other contexts, but I think it really applies here too, which is that it takes all types. Mm-hmm. And it's so frustrating for me when there's infighting within a field where everybody has the same goal because they're arguing about different approaches.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth of the matter is people have different skill sets. And some people are more extreme in one way and some people are less extreme in another way. And it's this constellation of amazing people and their skills and their efforts and their energy that collectively come together to solve a problem. Because as we all know, if you try to focus with only one perspective, you're not going to see the answer that's right in front of your face sometimes.
And you need all these types in global health. I mean, like this mm-hmm. is, here's a good example, right? So I'm not sure if you read, there was a, was it New York Times? I think it was New York Times, had this great post on how bed nets, these are things that are used for malaria. There's
yeah, like mosquito nets.
Uh-huh, the mosquito yeah. nets, right? So you look at this problem, right? You're like, okay, there's areas that are affected by malaria and this is, we need to protect people because people, like so many people die and there's so much, you know, disease that's caused by it. So we'll give them bed nets and we'll give them insecticide treated bed nets. That makes sense, right? Because you're looking at, mm-hmm. well, mosquitoes transmit it. Okay, this makes sense. That's like the public health science side of it, right? Okay, cool, right? But then if you're not putting that into perspective of the larger perspective, you're also giving these to people that, like, but they were doing this in communities, in fishing communities. And then they found that the people were using them as fishing nets.
Yeah.
So.
Which makes sense. You
right?
know, but it's something you would never even think about.
Exactly. Right. So like from a scientific perspective, you're like, well, duh, I'm going to give you a bed net. Like, okay, cool. You're protected from mosquitoes, right? Like that's, but then if you're not thinking larger, like you need someone else to kind of say, yeah, that's, I get what you're saying. And yes, that is one approach, but here's how it also could be used. Right. And then mm-hmm. there's people who, now there's the problems with it going, you know, potentially polluting the water.
Because they're treated with like DEET.
It could also affect food security because it's capturing mm-hmm. It's capturing the small fish.
Yeah, things that they're not usually
right.
Fishing for.
So there's just like it takes, you need all different people to kind of put their input in and say, oh yeah, that does seem like a good approach, but it's not going to work this because of this, you know?
That's so brilliant. Yeah. It's again, like it just goes back to what we were saying. It's almost impossible to see things from the perspective of people who are so very different and grew up under such different circumstances mm-hmm. until you've really been there. And so the last thing that you would want to do is not take their own perspectives into account.
Like another good example, and I just heard about this one, it's I think it was WHO came, I saw that they were advocating for this new needle. So for needle exchange programs, this is a way of reducing HIV because people are sometimes get, if they use drugs, they mm-hmm. share needles. And if they're infected with HIV, they can pass it on the person that they're sharing needles with. So if you just give people clean needles, that's a way of decreasing HIV transmission. And so there was this new innovative needle or something that came out. I think it couldn't be reused. I don't know. It was something special about it. And I thought, I was like, oh, okay. So WHO is coming out and saying this new, let's, you know, people should be using these needle in their needle exchange programs. And I remember talking to a colleague about it and sending this around and they're like, yeah, but you know what? Actually it doesn't, for some reason people aren't using it. Like the drug users wouldn't use it. So essentially, in places where they've tried to implement this and use all these needles, it didn't work because the people that were using drugs didn't like it for some reason. It was like a design issue.
Yeah. Like it was so singularly focused on making it so that you couldn't reuse it that they forgot that like it either hurts when you try
yeah,
to use
it was
it
something
or,
like that.
Or it doesn't like, you know, it doesn't work as well to actually get yeah. heroin into your body.
No, exactly. Yeah. So you have to think of it like from that, like we talk about that from the client perspective, mm-hmm. you know, so you can deal with like the one issue, but then there's the other side of it. So I thought that was another good one. I was like, huh, see, this is why you need crosstalk.
Yeah, no, seriously. And I think that that's such an important point that if there's anything that I'm going to take away from this talk even more than, I mean, I'm going to take away a lot, but but that's probably a really important thesis, I guess, that we were able to cover, which I'm excited about. And with that, we've been going for over an hour, which is just crazy. So it's that time where I ask you the same two questions that I ask all of my guests at the end of the podcast. And are you ready for them?
Oh, I'm ready.
Okay, good. So the first question being, you know, when you look to the future, what is it that keeps you up at night? What are you most concerned about? And then on the flip side, what are you optimistic about and looking forward to?
What keeps me up at night?
Yeah.
I would say one of the things that's bothering me most, and it's just, I think, it's within the past year has really started bothering me, is the effect of climate change on health.
Yeah, we don't usually think about that, do we?
No, we really don't. And for years, we've been talking about the potential for climate change on, you know, in terms of natural disasters and what it's doing to the environment, these sort of things. But I, at least in my experience and just in the past year, I've maybe just read more, seen more, heard more people speak up about, like, hey, yeah, like it's potentially going to have all these effects on the environment, but what are the effects going to be on health? Because, okay, sure, you have more natural disasters. Well, that can help us spread infectious diseases. You're going to have people that are moving inland, and then you're going to have more urbanization. That also is going to affect infectious diseases and certain things. That's going to affect mental health. You have displaced populations. You are going to potentially, I can't think of any non-communicable disease examples, but I do think that climate change is going to be a significant backdrop to our lives in,
completely.
You know,
and also you have like pests and vectors in areas that they
exactly
didn't live
that
before.
Too. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, exactly. The vectors, you have more, and you know, people going in potentially encroaching animal environments, so the emerging infectious diseases. So I think there's so many things to think about, and I really worry how prepared we are for it. That's what keeps me up at night. Is that are we ready? Are we doing the things that we need to do? And it's because I think so many things are going to be exacerbated with regard to health, and we're going to have faced new challenges in health. And I'm worried if enough of us are thinking ahead to the future about it. Now,
I think that's important. Yeah. It's funny because I would say that climate change is a very common response to that question, but this is definitely a different take on some of the detriment that climate change is going to bring. So it's just another reason that we need to be focused on that.
Exactly.
So let's talk about something happy.
Well, in terms of like I'm a more globally minded person, and I think one of the things I'm optimistic about is our ability as a race and as a global culture to respond and adapt to things that are come our way, you know, especially when it becomes a necessity. I am optimistic about that when some severe emergencies come at us, that we can quickly adapt and do something about it and work together, because we'll have to. And I think there's so much that we can learn from each other. There's so much innovation that can happen when we're forced to innovate and we're forced to deal with crises at hand. And I think, you know, from like a sciencey, geeky perspective, like that's some of the stuff I'm really excited to see, is when push comes to shove, what do we do? And how do we grow from it?
And I think that we have like plenty of historical examples to show that we're very good at banding together when we need
Absolutely.
And that definitely gives me hope for the future too. I mean, I know it's kind of sad or morbid or whatever to think that there are going to be many more big crises that we're going to have to deal with. But every time we do, we develop more and more tools and we learn more from our previous mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm glad that you're on our team and you'll be there to help mitigate some of these scary things that are happening. I'm glad that you are working on these really devastating diseases and trying to figure out ways to minimize them. You know, even if we can't eradicate everything, you know, we're well on our way with polio and the guinea worm, but even if some of these other things are going to continue to pop back up because there will be spillover events, it's good to know that there are amazing people out there who are putting a lot of time and effort and resources into figuring out how to keep us safe and keep us healthy, because that's, you know, ultimately one of the most important things that we could be putting our time and energy into.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I learned a lot.
I hope everybody listening learned a lot too. Before we go, I know that you're really active on social media. So why don't you let everybody know, you know, where they can find you online and say hello and all that good stuff.
Well, I think I'm probably most active on Twitter, and my handle is at Jessica Taff, and the correct spelling will be on Kara's website, so you can find it there. I think it's probably the best place. I'm just updating and sort of creating a new webpage for myself, so that's www.jessicataff.com. Again, the spelling should be there, so that'll be ready to go, and that'll hype even more about me.
By the way, it's a super weird spelling.
It is, yeah.
Where does it come from?
All right.
Taff.
Well, all right. So it's Irish.
Okay.
In terms of, that's my dad's side. And like there's even a Taff Castle out there. My parents have gone.
And it's spelled like this, T-A-A-F-F-E.
Yeah. 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 People get it wrong all the time. But
I'm sure they always call you Taffy. Taffy.
Yeah, I get that a lot. But I think even before that, it's Welsh probably. Like if you want to look into the historical movements and origins of it, but the... my family just tells me it's Irish.
Sure. And you're a halfie like me.
That's right. Halfies. Yeah.
Halfie. So you're, you said Paraguayan and then kind of European. I'm Puerto Rican Italian.
Yeah.
Hello.
Power to the halfies.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay.
My dad calls it hybrid vigor.
Oh, I like it. Right? I like it. Yeah. Well, and really power to people who are even more like, you know, spread out than we are. We're like early in the stage of being really evolved. I think people who are really like a big mixed bag of all sorts of cultures and ethnicities, they know what's up.
Yeah.
They're ahead of the curve.
Absolutely.
Anyway, well, thank you so much for joining
me. Thanks for having
me. It was a lot of fun. Everybody, reach out to Jessica, say hi on Twitter. And I hope you learned a lot just like I did. And I'm really happy that you keep coming back week after week. Thank you for that. I'm looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.